David, thank you for that introduction. It is an honor and a privilege and a pleasure to be back here. Let me thank President and Mrs. Starr for their hospitality, and let me thank the Jackson family for making this possible and their friends from Longview for coming to this event. And I want to express my particular appreciation to my friend David Smith, who has made this all possible and who has taken excellent care of me. Deficit reduction, not the sexiest of all subjects, but an important subject, is now not only in the air in Washington and in state capitals around the country, but on the political agenda and rising to the top. We had an election, a national election, last November, which was won overwhelmingly by the Republicans, fueled by the support of the Tea Party movement, whose animating principle was and is deficit reduction. And then the next month, two blue ribbon committees, two blue ribbon panels on the federal budget issued their report. The Bowles-Simpson Commission, which had been appointed by the president, and the Domenici-Rivlin Commission, which had been assembled by various Washington think tanks. These two reports differed in some ways, but they had important common features. They both said that the budget deficit was an urgent problem that had to be addressed seriously and could only be addressed seriously by sweeping across-the-board cuts, including cuts in defense and foreign policy spending. Now, in the new year, our Congress has taken up the task of reducing the federal budget deficit. That's what's going on in Washington. And although that process is far from complete, even for this session of Congress, I have to say that so far I've found it doubly disappointing. Disappointing in the first place because the deficit reduction being contemplated is so puny compared to the size of the problem. This year, we will run a budget deficit for the federal government of upwards of $1.5 trillion, this in a $14 trillion a year gross domestic product. And the argument in Washington is about whether the reduction should be 100 billion or 60 billion or 30 billion or 10 billion. Those really don't even approach the magnitude of the problem. This seems to me a little bit like the old adage about two bald men quarreling over a comb. It isn't really going to address our problem, and the process that's underway in Washington is disappointing, at least to me, for a second reason, and that is that the contemplated reductions are coming in the wrong place. The Congress, in its wisdom, has taken off the table federal spending on Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, and defense, and of course, we cannot default on the federal debt, on the money that we owe to bondholders. So that leaves about 15% of the budget to bear the burden of 100% of the cuts, and that 15% includes items that not only should we not cut, but where we should actually increase spending, because these items will give us higher economic growth in the future. We shouldn't skimp on those. We should be generous. I'm referring to research and development, for example, and education. So the budget process underway now, in this sense, reminds me of somebody who decides to lose weight by cutting off three of his fingers. He's not going to lose much weight that way, but he is going to handicap himself for anything else that he wants to do. Nonetheless, serious deficit reduction, which in my judgment is not what we have now, will sooner or later come to Washington. When it does come, it will affect the entire political climate and specifically the politics of American foreign policy. American foreign policy in response will, I believe, contract. We will do less in the world than we have become accustomed to doing over the past 4+ decades. And that contraction is the subject of my recent book, The Frugal Superpower. Now, let me start by noting that our deficit this year and the cumulative debt that we owe, that the debt being the sum total of all annual deficits, has three sources. The first source is the deficits we ran up between 2001 and 2007 with a huge unfunded tax cut, with two wars, and with the addition to our federal budget of another entitlement. This is the Medicare prescription drug entitlement. Well, that was pretty expensive. And then there was a second source of deficits, which proved even more expensive. And that consists of all the money that we had to spend to cope with the financial meltdown that was triggered by the collapse of the investment bank Lehman Brothers on September 15, 2008, and the Great Recession that it dramatically worsened. Fighting the recession, keeping the nation's financial system from collapsing, proved to be very, very expensive. But we face a third source of deficits, which is even greater. And that is the cost of our entitlement programs, Medicare and Social Security above all, which will skyrocket once the baby boom generation, that is those Americans born between 1946 and 1964, begins to retire and claim the benefits that we as a country have promised. And those born in 1946 turn 65 this year, so that wave is just beginning. The difference between the amount of money we can expect to collect over the years to pay those obligations and the total cost of those obligations, which is difficult to estimate, but the estimates of the gap there, the money we're going to have to find somewhere, range up to $100 trillion. Now, this will be over the course of decades, to be sure, but that is an enormous amount of money. Heretofore, we've dealt with the difference between what we take in taxes and what we pay out through the various programs to which the federal government is committed by borrowing money. We've borrowed more and more money, much of it from abroad, much of it from foreign governments, a lot of that from the government of China. But given the obligations that loom ahead, we simply won't be able to do this indefinitely. We will not be able to borrow enough money to cover the fiscal deficits that we have in view on our present course. That means that American economic policy is due for a sea change, a radical alteration. Specifically, that means that in the future, and I believe not the distant future, despite what our politicians have promised, taxes will go up, and they will go up for everybody. They won't just go up for rich people because there aren't enough rich people to pay what we need to fill our deficit gaps. And despite what our politicians have promised, benefits will be cut. People will not receive the full benefits of Social Security or Medicare that they have been promised, and in many cases, on which they are counting. Now, before moving to the consequences for foreign policy, and those consequences, as I say, will be a contraction, because when people are paying more to the government and getting less from it, they are going to be less generous than they have been in the past about everything, including funding the kind of foreign policy to which we have become accustomed. But before talking about the reductions that I see in our future, let me make two general observations about this moment in history and what I believe lies ahead. First, if, or I would say when, our fiscal circumstances compel us to pull back in the world, this will mark an historical turning point. The United States, uniquely among countries, has been a country that for more than seven decades, I would say since the beginning of World War II, has bothered relatively little about the cost of its foreign policy. When presidents and their administrations have contemplated foreign policies, really since the beginning of World War II, almost never have they asked themselves the question that every other country has had to ask itself throughout history. namely, what will it cost? Cost hasn't been absolutely negligible, but it's been far less important for us than for any other country in the world, and I would say for any other country in history. That, I believe, is going to change, and that's point one. Point two is that when it does change, this will have an important, perhaps a profound effect, not only on the United States, but also on the rest of the world. Indeed, I would say that the retrenchment of American foreign policy may turn out to be more important for other countries than it is for our own. The reason is that the United States plays a unique, and I believe uniquely constructive, role in the world. The United States carries out some of the roles and provides some of the services to other countries that governments ordinarily provide to the people they govern within the societies where they operate. That is to say, the United States operates to some extent as the world's government. As the United States retrenches, the world will get less governance. No country or group of countries is likely to step in and fill the governance gap that we leave. And in general, I believe that will be bad for the world. That risks making the world less prosperous and more disorderly. Well, as the United States pulls back, what policies, what services, what functions are likely to be reduced or discarded altogether? This country plays a very important role in the global economy, and some of the global economic functions that the United States carries out will certainly be cut back. One of them already has been. Especially for the first decade of this century, the United States served as the world's consumer of last resort. Exporting countries, especially in Asia, could count on selling much of what they produced for export to the United States. Since the Great Recession, that is no longer true to the same extent. American consumers, having to balance their accounts, have cut back. And this has hurt exporters all over the world. And the American taste for massive consumption is not likely to return soon. There is another global economic service that the United States provides that is in some jeopardy. The United States provides the world's major currency. The dollar is a reserve currency that different countries hold to back up the money they issue, and it's also a vehicle currency. Many countries engage in trade and investment between and among themselves using dollars. Well, confidence in the dollar is drooping because foreigners look at the United States, see the enormous deficits we're running up, and worry that this country will deal with its deficits the way many other countries in history have done, by printing money to pay them off, by inflating the currency, in which case the dollars that they hold will lose value. So people around the world are nervous about this central global currency. Now, it's not likely that any other currency will replace the dollar anytime soon. The euro is in trouble itself, and the Chinese currency, the renminbi, is not remotely qualified to serve this purpose yet. But it does mean that the world's most important currency may well command less and less confidence, and that will be bad for everybody involved in the global economy. There's yet another kind of policy that, current events seemingly to the contrary notwithstanding, I believe will be discontinued. I believe that we will see fewer and perhaps no more of the kinds of military interventions in which the United States engaged over the last two decades. Beginning with the end of the Cold War, the United States sent troops to Somalia, to Haiti, to Bosnia, to Kosovo, to Iraq, and to Afghanistan. Now, these military interventions had different motives and were undertaken by two rather different administrations, but they did have one thing in common. Each of them encumbered the United States with a mission that was unexpected, unwanted, expensive, and frustrating. The mission of nation building, of trying to construct working governmental institutions where they had broken down or whether none or where none had existed before. The American public does not welcome this kind of mission, and I believe will not pay for more such missions. The current operations over Libya, I suspect, will turn out to be the exception that proves the rule. Note that the president did not go to Congress for authorization for this operation, in part, I suspect, because he knew that he would not get it. Note also that the president has promised that this will be of limited duration, that the United States will play only a limited role, and above all, that there will be no American boots on the ground, that the United States will not send troops to become entangled in the domestic affairs of Libya. I hope that this is correct, but I do confidently predict that if the president is not able to keep to his promises, the Libya mission will very rapidly become extremely unpopular in the country and in the Congress. Well, another place where we will see the retrenchment of American foreign policy is in the American defense budget. Secretary Gates has already proposed some reductions, or more properly, reductions in the planned increases in defense spending. But I think what we're seeing this year in this budget cycle is only the tip of the iceberg. My sense is that over the next decade, we will see an increasingly fierce battle in the Congress between the proponents of high and higher defense spending and those who wish to cut it. And over time, I anticipate that the champions of lower defense spending will gain the upper hand against the background of reduced spending on entitlements and rising taxes. Now, I say this will be a fierce battle because defense spending has politically powerful champions. And defense spending also has politically powerful and politically salient arguments. We do get valuable things from the dollars, the hundreds of billions of dollars that we spend on defense. Among other things, the American defense budget funds what I regard as the three most important missions in American foreign policy: our presence in three crucial regions of the world, East Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. I believe that those missions should be continued and that the capacity of the United States to continue them is the basic test of America's ability to continue to provide global leadership in a cash-strapped era. So let me turn to each of them. In Europe and in East Asia, American military forces and the American political presence play the same, in my view, valuable role. The United States serves as a buffer between and among countries that are not explicitly enemies, but that don't really trust each other and like to have the United States around. The presence of the United States reassures them that the security environment is not going to change suddenly and unfavorably. In Europe, for example, the American presence reassures Germany and other Western European and Central European countries that should post-communist Russia resume the kind of aggressive foreign policy that the Soviet Union carried out, the United States will be on hand to help deter it. But at the same time, the American presence in Europe and the persistence of the NATO alliance reassures the Russians that Germany, which after all invaded and occupied Russia twice in the first half of the last century, will remain firmly and safely anchored in an American-led alliance. Similarly, in East Asia, the American presence reassures the Japanese and other countries of the region that if China should adopt an aggressive foreign policy, the United States will be on hand to help check it. But at the same time, the Japanese-American Security Treaty, which is the linchpin of the American military presence in the Asia-Pacific region, reassures China, which was invaded and occupied by Japan in the 1930s and 1940s, that Japan will not go off on an independent course in foreign policy, that might ultimately redound to the disadvantage of China. So the American presence is welcomed in one degree or another by virtually every major country in both these regions. Now, the great danger in these two regions is that Russia or China or both might adopt an aggressive foreign policy. This is not beyond the realm of possibility. After all, Russia and China are not Scandinavian countries that care only about social justice within their borders and having good relations with their neighbors. They are large, ambitious countries, both of which express some dissatisfaction with the political and military status quo in their regions. So a dangerous Russia or a dangerous China is not out of the question. In the frugal superpower, I give my best guess, and it can only be a guess, about the future course of Russian and Chinese foreign policies. And in both cases, my guess is that neither is likely to disrupt the status quo. For China, a stable international economic order is all important for what is most important to them, and that is their continued rapid economic growth. They need peace and stability to continue to be able to import capital, to get investment from abroad, and to export their manufactured goods. And my guess is that the Chinese leadership will bend over backward not to disturb the status quo in East Asia for that region, for that reason. Similarly, I believe that Russia is unlikely to disturb the status quo, partly for the same reason. Russia needs a calm international economic order in order to sell to the rest of the world the only product Russia has that anybody else wants to buy, and that is energy. But I expect Russia not to make trouble for a reason that it does not have in common with China. China is a rising power. Russia is a declining one, and my best guess is that China is simply not going to be powerful enough to try to overturn the political and military status quo in Europe, even if it were disposed to do so. Well, that brings me to the Middle East, a region that is both crucial and dangerous. It's crucial because the world's largest readily accessible supplies of oil are located there. It's dangerous because it's in upheaval in general at the moment, and also because it is home to the Islamic Republic of Iran, which openly works to expel the United States from the Middle East, dominate the region, and hold sway over its oil, which would be a huge geopolitical setback for the United States and its allies. In my view, the most important geopolitical task for the United States today, not just in the Middle East but in the world, is to continue to check Iran's ambitions. And needless to say, if Iran succeeds in acquiring nuclear weapons, which it is certainly trying to do, the task of containing Iran will be that much more difficult. Now, the task of containing Iran and the task of checking Russia and or China, should that be necessary, will depend on the United States. In calculating their policies, all three of these countries will decide what kinds of foreign policies to carry out, in no small part by assessing what response a more aggressive policy might meet. The response to such a policy depends very heavily on the United States, on American power, on American resources, and on American resolve. And given the fact that we are entering a cash-strapped era, all three of those, unfortunately, are going to be in relatively short supply in the years ahead. Well, in dealing with the world that we face in a cash-strapped era, and especially, but not exclusively, with the Middle East, there is one policy I believe the United States can and should productively carry out. And I devote some attention to it in the last chapter of The Frugal Superpower. That policy is to consume less oil. If you look around the world, not just in the Middle East, but in other parts of the world as well, The countries that make the most trouble for the United States do so with resources that they get from the sale of their oil. If we consume less oil, and if the world consumes less oil, they will have fewer resources with which to make trouble. Iran is the best example. The Islamic Republic depends almost exclusively on oil. But another example is Vladimir Putin's Russia, which depends very heavily on oil revenue, as does the Venezuela of President Chavez, America's nemesis in this hemisphere. Cutting back on our consumption would cut back on the resources that America's adversaries have in the world. And since the United States is the largest consumer of oil in the world, if we consume less, the total consumption, and therefore the total revenues accruing to these unfriendly governments, would decline. Well, how can we do this? There is a simple policy that we could follow. Simple, but seemingly politically impossible. And that policy is to raise substantially the gasoline tax. If Americans paid as much for gasoline as the Western Europeans and Japanese do, and they typically pay 2.5 to 3 times as much as we do, there would be two effects, and they would become evident almost immediately. The first effect would be conservation. We would all use less oil. The second would be substitution. Alternative forms of energy would become economically competitive, and investment in them would pour in. Electric cars would suddenly become competitive with gasoline-fueled cars if the price of gasoline were higher. So not only would we effectively help our foreign policy, if we were to raise the price of gasoline, we would accrue many other benefits as well. For example, it would help with global warming. It would mean the emission of fewer greenhouse gases. It would help with our balance of payments deficit, because we pay hundreds of billions of dollars every year to the people who sell us oil. And if we raised the price on gasoline, the federal government would have more revenue. So it would help, although it would certainly not solve our budget deficit problem. But most of all, in my judgment, because of the geopolitical consequences of our and the world's dependence on oil, there is no single measure that would do more to strengthen the American position in the world and to promote American values in the world than to raise the price of gasoline and consume less. If we did so, it would demonstrate something that the world desperately needs, and that is in all too short a supply today. And that is American global leadership in a cash-strapped era. Thank you.